Welcome to Unreal, the season of the witch. We have reached the last and largest witch trial in Ireland. Most of the stories I have been dealing with in this October's season of the witch show how community's suspicion focuses on a single woman, working alone, or at least as the ringleader of a group. It is this woman who faces the worst suspicion, and she who bears the brunt of the town's accusation. But sometimes, when a community is particularly afraid, or a supposed victim particularly vindictive, sometimes then, whispers and rumors can fly even further, and many rumored witches can stand trial for the same crime. A fear of witchcraft grows into something bigger altogether, a witch panic. We have seen this happen across the world, from Lancashire in Britain to Salem in America. In Ireland, it's only reported to have happened once. But as we'll soon see, once was enough to do plenty of harm. I'm Ruth Atkins, and this is Unreal. After Florence Newton's trial and death in Youghal, County Cork, another witch trial took place, in another religious community. This time, it happened in Éilean Magee, a small coastal parish near Carrickfergus in County Antrim. Antrim, at the time, had dealt with its fair share of witch trials and panics. In 1672, the deaths of James Shaw and his wife were believed by their neighbours to have been the work of witchcraft. 26 years later, in 1698, a 9-year-old girl in Antrim town became very sick after eating a sorrel leaf, and the community became convinced that the elderly woman who gave it to her had bewitched it. That woman was condemned and tortured by strangling and burning until she confessed to witchcraft and a host of other crimes. Unsurprisingly, these events were occurring at a time of political and religious turbulence, both for Antrim and for the country as a whole. The wealth and government of Ireland at this time was in the hands of Anglican gentry, the Protestant ascendancy, whose position had been greatly strengthened by William of Orange's victory against the Catholic James II in the Battle of the Boyne in 1690. Meanwhile, the Jacobean plantation of Ulster, coupled with famine and poor harvests in Scotland, had led to a wave of emigration of Presbyterian settlers into the north of Ireland. By 1710, about a third of the population of Ulster was Presbyterian. These early Presbyterian communities had a divided identity. They saw themselves as Scottish rather than English or Irish, but they remained loyal to the British Crown. Their status left them isolated and persecuted from all sides, from the Church of England, who viewed their differing religious practices as a sign of dissent, and from the Gaelic Irish, who hadn't taken kindly to a century of bloodshed and colonisation. This is where witch panics thrive, in isolated communities and in times of turmoil. Looking for stability, people turn to religious fervour to strengthen their bonds. And in a time when all Christian denominations viewed magic as dangerous and the devil as a very real presence, strong religious feeling led to strong feelings of fear and suspicion, often with devastating consequences. If Florence Newton's story began with a kiss, this story begins with a house. Knowhead House in Island McGee, home to Mrs. Anne Haltridge and her family. Anne was the widow of the late Reverend John Haltridge, a Presbyterian minister, and she was a respected and well-known member of the community. Knowhead House was respectable also, a thick-walled, two-story dwelling that the family had lived in for many years. But in the year 1710, strange things began to happen to the house and to the people who lived there. Things that they felt could only be explained by magic. In the autumn of that year, Anne Haltridge began to be troubled by a strange presence that pelted her with stones, disturbed the furniture in her room, and at night, she could feel it crawling over her body. Then, as the months passed, a boy appeared, dressed in rags and behaving in a very sinister manner. The boy kept his face covered, and he jeered and threatened Anne and her family. When the servants closed the door against him, the boy threw a stone and shouted out to them, "You think you are safe, but I can come in through the smallest hole in the house, like a cat or a mouse, for the devil can make me anything I please." The boy was later seen frightening the turkeys, digging a grave, and jumping over the garden wall, almost as if he could fly. The boy eventually vanished, and although the Haltridges and their neighbours combed the countryside searching for him, he was never found again. Anne and her family were sure that this was proof of what the boy truly was, a demon sent from hell. Although the boy had disappeared, the strange attacks on Anne and the house continued, the Haltridges said. Stones and sods of earth battered the walls and windows. In February, Anne's bedclothes were repeatedly found stripped from her bed and bundled together with a sheet lying over them, almost in the shape of a corpse. But Anne refused to move out of the room. She was not going to give in to the devil's wishes, she said. Eventually, the trouble became so great that the new minister was called for, a man called Robert Sinclair. Together with his ruling elders and several other pious members of the community, Sinclair came to Knowhead House, determined to drive out the demonic forces that had taken hold of it. As darkness fell, they fasted and prayed, and Anne went to bed early. But later, at midnight, they heard her scream. Rushing up to Anne's room, the people found Anne convulsing and complaining about a pain in her back. The pain was sharp, like something was stuck into her, she said. It was like a knife. Too frightened, finally, to stay where she was, Anne was taken to the guest bedroom. But the shock, fear, and pain had been too great. 7 days later, Anne Haltridge was dead. Now, these events do make for a good ghost story, but it seems pretty clear to us today that whatever was going on in the house, it probably wasn't haunted. The boy, if he existed at all, was most likely just a beggar, the stories of what he did sensationalized after the events that followed. Wind and drafts can explain the movements of stones, and as for Mrs. Holtridge, the stress of such events and her belief in their evil origins may well have been the cause for her sudden ill health and death. Still, whether or not Anne Holtridge's torment was truly magical, the supernatural elements seemed real enough to the community to cause widespread consternation and suspicion. People were convinced that real and dangerous magic was at play, and the rumours of what or who might have played a part were already flying fast. So, the stage was set for accusations to begin to take a far uglier turn. After Anne Holtridge's death, people came from all around, both to sympathise with her family and probably to see the bewitched house for themselves. Among them was a young woman called Mary Dunbar, a cousin of the Holtridges, who arrived 5 days later to keep Anne's daughter company in her grief. Mary was 18 years old, an intelligent and respected gentlewoman, so the accounts say. And when she first arrived, Mary did not seem afraid of the supernatural occurrences in the way that the others in the house were. On the first night that Mary arrived, she went up to her room with one of the other girls in the house. And when they opened the door, they found that their clothes had been scattered all over the floor. Among the scattered clothes, they found an apron that neither of them owned. It had been tied with 9 knots. The other women of the house were afraid to touch the apron, believing it to be bewitched. But Mary took hold of it and untied each of the knots herself. Within the folds, she found a cap that had belonged to Anne Holtridge. The following morning, when Mary was going upstairs, she suddenly doubled over from a sharp pain in her leg. By evening, she had begun to have violent fits, crying out that a knife was running through her thigh, and that she could see a vision of 3 women standing close to her, who she described. By midnight, this crowd of spectres had grown to 8 women who crowded around her, Mary said, and called to each other by name. Because of this, though she was not from the community, Mary was now able to identify the women, she said, and she began calling them out. Now, Mary did not live near Island McGee, as I've said, and she insisted that she had never seen or met these women before, that the names were coming to her completely from out of the blue. The others in the house believed, therefore, that the names could only have come to the girl by evil magic, a pure sign of witchcraft. But what seems to have been overlooked is the fact that Mary was a relation and a close friend of the Holtridges, so could easily have heard the names from them. Also overlooked was that she had been in the house for a day already, hearing the speculation and talk that had been going on around her. And the descriptions she gave for those she couldn't name were detailed, but were things that could apply to any number of people. Short, stout, lame, a dirty headdress, or a rolling eye. Mary even named the relations of the neighbours who were already gathered there at No Head House. One of the women accused, Janet Carson, her daughter was there at No Head during Mary's fit and accusation. She was understandably horrified to hear her mother being named. It was actually this woman, the daughter, who involved the Reverend Sinclair again, hoping that he would intercede and make Mary Dunbar see sense. But the Reverend Sinclair did no such thing. He called for Janet Carson to be brought to the house and taken up to Mary's room. As soon as Janet approached, Mary flew into a still more violent fit, crying out, "Janet Carson is here!" The shocked older woman was immediately taken away from Mary, brought into another room, and told to pray for Mary's fits to improve. Janet Carson refused to do this at first. "Why? I have done the girl no wrong," she said. But the Reverend, and all the people who mattered, thought otherwise. One thing that's interesting to note here is how similar all of these 17th and 18th century witchcraft accusations were. Mary Dunbar's symptoms were the same as Longdon's in Yall, and were also the same as the young girl in Antrim Town in 1698, as well as countless other witch trials across Britain. Each time, a young girl accused an old woman, or women, of putting her under a spell that caused fits, fear, and pain, and symptoms that were the same across each of the cases. The tests carried out on the women by the Reverend Sinclair and his men were similar also, making them say the Lord's Prayer and bringing them up to Mary's room to gauge her reaction. Given these similarities, we have to wonder, is it possible that Mary Dunbar had read or heard about these previous witchcraft trials? She was an intelligent and likely educated woman. During her fits, she cried out in biblical language, suggesting she was well read. And witch trials were easy to read about. Just like today, stories of witches gained fame and interest, were gossiped and preached about, and pamphlets and sermons were readily available, laying out every little detail of what had happened in the trials. So, did Mary know the things that should be said to make the people around her pay attention and believe her? And, if she knew that, did she know the fate she could be condemning the women she named to face? It almost seems too awful to believe that a person could make the whole thing up, knowing the punishment she might be inflicting upon them. But such things are not unheard of. Mary had also named a mother and daughter, Jane and Elizabeth Seller, so they were brought reluctantly and tested as well. The Reverend Sinclair was so convinced by the results of the tests he had carried out that he went straight to the authorities instead of the church, involving the mayor of Carrickfergus, Edward Clements, as well as the constables and watchmen of the local area. Having discovered proof of the three witches, the authorities believed Mary totally, and as she had said in her visions that seven or eight figures were crowded around her, they began to look for the others. In all, Mary's names and descriptions led to the arrests of seven women from Island Magee and the surrounding area. It was the largest witch panic ever recorded in Ireland. The women were Janet Main of Braid Island, Jane Latimer of Carrickfergus, Margaret Mitchell of Kilroot, and Catherine McCalmont, Janet and Elizabeth Seller, and Janet Carson, all of Island Magee. It's not surprising that these were the women accused. They were all known for being ignorant or bad-tempered, or ugly, or had distinctive features that mark them out as different from the people around them. Catherine McCalmont was lame or crippled, while Janet Lattimore had one eye that was blind and sunk into her head. Elizabeth Seller, the youngest person accused, who was just 17, was also lame. And she and her mother had already been under suspicion from the community of practicing witchcraft in times before this. They were all outcasts, in other words. People the community had no time for, and easy targets when rumour and suspicions were flying. At the trial, Mary Dunbar did not perform a dramatically violent fit in the way that Mary Longdon had done at Yall. She actually did not give evidence or even speak at all. The people watching her during the trial described how she was silent and her eyes cast about the room in a wild and distracted manner. When she was raised up to give evidence, Mary appeared to faint, sinking back down into the arms of the person supporting her, and closed her eyes. After the trial, Mary claimed that she had been struck dumb by the witches, forbidden from giving evidence against them, and that three spectral figures at all times were guarding her closely. Soon after the trial, she also accused another member of the Seller family, this time the father, William Seller, and he too faced trial, although his fate is unknown. After the evidence had been given, the seven accused witches were brought forward and were asked to offer their own defence. They each denied the charges, and unlike Florence Newton's trial, there was more said in their defence. Some of them were industrious, hard-working women, it was claimed. Some were even religious, known to pray with their families and say the Lord's Prayer, and several had even taken communion recently. All things, it was believed, witches could not do. 50 years had passed since Florence Newton's trial, after all. And although there had been witchcraft accusations since then, it seems likely that rationality was beginning to win out to a certain level, that people had begun to weigh up the evidence for themselves and were not as sure as they had been that an accusation was a certainty. These changing times, and the fact that Mary Dunbar was still alive and well, also meant that the fates of these women were very different to past cases. One of the judges at the trial, Judge Upton, told the jury that the women could not be found guilty based on the evidence given. It did not seem possible to him that pious women who attended church regularly could be witches. The other judge, though, Mr. Justice McCartney, disagreed, feeling that the evidence was there. The jury deliberated and returned their verdict. The women were indeed guilty, they said, but they were not sentenced to death. Instead, they were given a year's imprisonment and made to stand in the pillory 4 times during their sentence. Now, I don't want to play down the fates that these women suffered. The pillory punishment was brutal and humiliating. It involved standing with your head and arms encased in a wooden bar, while the watching crowd could heckle and throw things at you. The women were pelted with egg and cabbage stalks. One of them, it was reported, lost an eye to the violence. It was a horrific fate, but it wasn't death. And after this, no more witches stood trial in Ireland. In fact, the early 18th century marked the end of witch trials across Ireland and Britain. The last trial in England taking place in 1717, and Scotland's last trial in 1722. Things were changing in each country, as more and more people began to view witch panics as foolish superstition instead of true religious practice. But although they no longer stood trial in traditional courts, the ordeals of suspected witches were not quite over. Among the superstitious, less educated, and insular communities, fear and suspicion still brought devastating results. And as we will see in next week's episode, Ireland's last and most horrifying witch case was still to come.
I am but a part of this. All I am is all I give. Everything that comes to me comes as sure as I will breathe.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Unreal. You can find links to the sources and music from today's episode on my website, unrealpodcast.com. The song you are listening to right now is All of This by Ayla Nerio. If you enjoyed today's episode, please do tell a friend or leave a review wherever you get your podcast. Thanks to everyone who has done that so far. Unreal was written and created by me, Ruth Atkins. I'll be back next week with the conclusion to this witchy chapter and the tragic story of Bridget Cleary. Until then, Gunairi on Boherlat.
Everything that comes to me comes as sure as I will breathe.